Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Amy Rossi. Amy received her MFA from Louisiana State University, and she lives in North Carolina by way of Massachusetts with her partner and two dogs. And the book that we're talking about today is her first novel, which I actually kind of find almost unbelievable, The Cover Girl. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Amy.
Thank you so much. It's so wonderful to be here. I really appreciate it.
And why I say that I find that almost unbelievable is because when I was reading it, I just assumed that you had published a lot because it's so well done.
Well, thank you so much. That means a lot.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about The Cover Girl, what it's about, and why you wrote it.
Okay. The Cover Girl is the story of Bertie Rhodes, and it follows her across two timelines. In the 1970s, she's discovered by legendary modeling agent Harriet Goldman, and she ends up posing for an album cover a couple years later. She's 13 when she's discovered, and she's 15 when she poses for this album cover. And the rock star involved in that album makes himself both her boyfriend and her legal guardian. And so we have one timeline that follows everything after that throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And then in 2018, we meet Bertie, and she's now going by Elizabeth, and she's a woman in her 50s, making kind of a workaday living as a model in catalogs and for anti-aging supplies and that kind of thing. And then she receives an invitation to a gala that's honoring Harriet's 50-year career. And that prompts her to revisit her relationship with Harriet and how the rock star played a role in that and why it ended.
Okay, so it's really interesting because just coincidentally, my guest last week, Paula Saunders, author of Starting From Here, that book was also, in a sense, about what happens to young women in our culture and in our society over the last however many years, where the other book was about a girl who leaves home to try and become a professional ballet dancer. And of course, your book is about a girl who leaves home to become a, you know, model, or she is a model, but to further her modeling career. And boy, we don't protect our young women very well, do we?
We really don't. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to write this book. I remember finding out about stories like this as a teenage classic rock fan, watching Behind the Music and that kind of thing. And I was wondering, you know, why don't we talk about this all the time? And I think the answer's right there, right? I grew up in the era of Britney Spears, and, you know, she wasn't protected by the people around her. And I've seen so many young women, famous and not protected. And I think you can kind of draw a squiggly line from these moments to where we are now. And just the idea of, like, teenage girls is a status symbol for powerful men. And that's really terrifying. And that's something we really have to reckon with.
And one of the things that is so, I don't know, so moving about your book is that Bertie doesn't really recognize the truth about what happened to her until so much later. And I wonder if that is true of most, because, you know, she was in this world of glamour and fame and you know, attention, and not realizing the true price that she was paying for it.
Yeah. When people look back at this time, everybody wants to say, or not everybody, but people want to say, you know, it was a different time. And I think that can be true to an extent, but I also think there's a heavy level of self-preservation involved, right? For Bertie, it was her way of protecting herself and being able to move forward in her life was to kind of deny any...
deny that she was exploited.
Right, deny any negative feelings or like push back against like people who want to kind of try and help her, because that's survival.
But the thing is that she wanted to deny that she was being exploited, but so she blamed herself instead.
Yes,
she blamed herself and internalized the negative results of what had happened to her.
Yes. Yeah. She really puts a lot of pressure on herself and the choices she's made. And it takes her a long time to realize that she wasn't making those choices.
Yeah. And yeah, so you say, well, that was a different time, but is it any better now? I mean, it's still happening.
It's still happening. It just happens, I think. We didn't have social media then, so you know, you can't put somebody on blast if you see them out with a, or you couldn't put somebody on blast if you saw them out with a 14-year-old back in the day, and now you can, but it still happens.
So in the cover girl, her rock star boyfriend is never named. So why did you choose that to do that? Was there someone in particular that you had in mind that you just? But you didn't want to open yourself up to a lawsuit?
The thing is, there was no shortage of inspiration for him. But I also was very aware that, you know, there are some stories people know better than others. And so there is the practical choice of, like, you know, it's probably easiest not to name him. But that kind of became, it took on, like, a larger meaning to me, because I think it doesn't matter who he is, right? Men like him have had so much airtime, and he's going to be fine. There's not ever really been any accountability for men in power who abuse women, or young girls, really. He's going to be fine. And he's had his chance to tell his story, and his story is the dominant narrative. When you read memoirs or you watch documentaries, you know, girls like Birdie might be a footnote or a talking head very briefly, but they're not the main story. And so by taking his name out of it, I could really put the focus on her story. And, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, if you love his music or you don't love his music or any of that. It's about her and what she experienced.
And was there a particular young girl or person that Birdie is modeled after?
No, she's kind of an amalgam of many girls. I had written my master's thesis novel about hair metal groupies. And as I was looking at these girls in the 80s metal scene, I kept, you know, finding my research would bring me back a few years into the 70s. And so the girls who were in Star 1973, or Star Magazine in 1973, they were very young girls who were hanging on the rock scene. So that's a bit of inspiration. The career of Brooke Shields is a little bit of inspiration. Pat Cleveland, the model, she had similar experiences. I think there's, unfortunately, much like the rock star, there was no shortage of young girls to kind of research and find out information on to sort of make my own Birdie out of them.
Now, there's brief reference to Elvis in here, because he dies during the tour, one of the tours. And the thing I'm wondering is why, I mean, how old was Priscilla when he?
She was 14.
Mm-hmm. Why do we still sort of seem to think that wasn't so bad?
I think literally for Elvis, it's because he waited till she was like 18 or 19 to marry her. And by all accounts, their relationship did not get physical until she was an adult. But like, that's still not okay. She was uprooted from her life and her family in another country because her father was in the army and brought over to Tennessee with nothing into this crazy world where he was already so famous. And I think it's the status symbol thing again, or like somebody who's like never going to tell you no, or who's doesn't know better.
Yeah. And maybe we don't want to criticize it too much because she seemed to have turned out okay. It's like, you know, it's like, well, she made peace with it.
I think that's also one of the reasons that I was really drawn to the story is because how do you handle changing feelings about your own life, both internally and externally? How, what does it feel like when people tell you the life you lived was wrong?
Right.
How do you come to terms with that?
And that you were a victim.
Mm-hmm. And maybe you didn't
feel like it at the time or didn't. Yeah.
And do you have room to change your mind about it?
Yeah.
As you get older and get more perspective.
And you talk about Brooke Shields in the mm-hmm. book. She is also a little bit younger than Birdie, just a few years. It sort of eclipses her quite a bit in the modeling world. I remember there was some attention on when Brooke did those the Calvin ads that people mm-hmm. were like, what is this girl's mother thinking, letting her do this? And yet, yeah. again, Brooke seems, I mean, she had a fabulous career. Has she ever spoken out about her young years?
Yes. Her documentary, There Was a Little Girl, or not her but memoir, There Was a Little Girl, talks about this time, and especially the scrutiny her mother was under. And then I think in late 2023, she released a documentary that's available on Hulu called Pretty Baby, Brooke Shields. And she talks, the footage from that documentary is so uncomfortable, but it's so enlightening. Because even the people who were trying to rush to her defense, the media, you know, holding up her mother for scrutiny and all of that, the questions they're asking her are just as objectifying and just as uncomfortable as the ads and the movies she was in. And it's
well,
just,
it's yes.
scary.
And that also reminds me or makes me think about the Monica Lewinsky case where, mm-hmm. you know, I still don't know what to think about that because she was an adult woman, a young adult woman, but she was not a teenager. And when she had this relationship with Bill Clinton, and the media really victimized her more than in trying to say how horrible it was that he had done this to her, victimized her more maybe than the actual relationship did. And
yeah.
It's like, how do you defend and protect these girls and not play a role of victimizing them all over again?
I think that's really hard. And I think we're in a really awkward position with that now, with the Epstein scandal. You know, there's this emphasis on names and like who's on the list. And those girls have told us everything
yeah.
that you need to know, and to reiterate it re-victimizes them.
Yeah, that whole thing's puzzling. And there you have a woman, I don't know how you pronounce her name, Ghislaine Maxwell? Do you know mm-hmm. how you say that?
I think it's Ghislaine.
Ghislaine Maxwell.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Who participated in that victimization of her. And I'm glad that in the cover girl, you didn't have that.
mm-hmm. I think people have been concerned about what Harriet's role really was. And I think Harriet was just doing her best given the time. And she needed Birdie to say something to her. But Harriet meant well, even if the impact wasn't always what she intended.
She tried. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So now you said that you were doing a master's thesis about
my the novel that I wrote for my master's thesis was about 80s hair metal groupies.
So what were you getting a master's degree in?
Creative writing.
Oh. And what drew you to 80s hair metal groupies?
I think so I'm 40 now, and so I was a teenager at the turn of the millennium, and there was just so much 80s nostalgia programming and 70s nostalgia programming, and I think that really informed who I became as a writer, this idea of looking back and, like, whose story survives, and that's the music that I liked as a teenager, even though, you know, that wasn't the popular music at the time. And when I was watching all these shows and I would learn about the girls behind the bands and everything they were doing to, like, help the bands be successful, and how concentrated it was in this, you know, couple square miles on the Sunset Strip with all these clubs. I just thought that was fascinating, and I wanted to tell those girls' stories because, again, they always ended up being footnotes to somebody else's story.
So when you were researching that, I'm assuming you interviewed some of these girls?
I did not, but I'm hoping to for my next book.
Oh, okay. Okay. Because I'm wondering, like, where are they now?
I'm hoping to answer that question in my next book as well.
Oh, good. So the Cover Girl is set partially in New York and partially in LA, a little bit other places too, but those are the two main scenes. Are you familiar with both of those areas?
I am less familiar with New York. I had to do some research there. I put most of her time in LA in West Hollywood, and I have taken a couple research trips to West Hollywood, but I was in the LA Times archives. I was in the New York Times archives. I was in Google Maps, like, walking along the street with her, looking at retro photos and that kind of thing. So I did, I think that's how she ended up in Boston a little bit, because that was a place I did have a connection to. But I do tend to end up writing about places that I have less of a personal connection to.
Well, it's a good excuse for travel.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So as a model, the scenes where she's actually modeling feel very real. And, of course, I know nothing about modeling, but... do you have experience in that world?
When I was in fifth grade, I begged my mother to let me take modeling school courses at John Robert Powers. And that is the extent of my knowledge, but I can still bust out my runway walk at a party if needed. but I did do a lot of theater in college, so I think some of that... And when Birdie makes her foray into a little bit of acting, I definitely drew on some of those experiences. But again, that was a lot of research and hoping I got it right.
Have you had any feedback from actual models on this book?
I have not. That would be a dream. I would love to get it in the hands of Brooke Shields.
Oh,
Brooke,
yeah.
If you're out there.
Absolutely.
Yes.
It would be interesting to get her feedback on it, to get her take, to see, you know, how, I mean, for me, it seemed very real, but, you know, I've never been there.
That's the challenge with writing about something like this, is that you can do so much research and you can drive yourself crazy trying to figure out getting all the technical details right. And then at some point I just had to tell myself, like, if Brooke Shields or Beverly Johnson or somebody wants to come and tell you you got that wrong, like, that is okay. That means they read your book, and most people will know what you're, will believe what you said.
Ah, right. Would you like to read a little bit from the Cover Girl for us, Amy?
Sure. I have a little section ready for you. This is from a 2018 section after Birdie has gotten her invitation to the gala honoring Harriet. The invitation still sits on the countertop, Harriet's Girls. I haven't been called one of those in years. The legend is this: a young woman answers phones at a famous modeling agency, the famous modeling agency. Eventually, she's one of the ones booking jobs and negotiating rates. She sees careers bloom and fall, sees the four seasons of a girl's potential unfold in a week. She sees the distinction between fashion and commercial and what pays what. She sees an assumption that girls will eventually get married and have babies, so who needs longevity? And she sees 1968 on the calendar and knows the times, they are a-changin'. She sees everything and is invisible to everyone. She sees a girl leave the agent's office in tears after being told the usual things that boil down to no. Too heavy, too plain, too boring, too much in any direction, and also not enough. But this one is different. The young woman sees what the agent cannot. She knows about a job. She has earned trust. She has connections. The girl books the job and then practically overnight, Vogue. She becomes a star. The young woman is fired and lands on her feet at a smaller agency where the founder is tired of competing with the big famous one and so lets the young woman take the reins. Scout, scout, an agent's agent, and booker's book, except when the young woman sees true potential and decides a girl is worth taking a more active role for. No need to wait for someone to come to your doorstep when she could be walking down the street. Find them early and build a career. Find them early and help them make some money. Tell the story about Grace Kelly's origins at every chance. Find them early before the big agency does. Find them early, and they will always be her girls. Maybe that last part isn't true. How much of the rest is? Does it matter? I didn't realize we were a thing, that I was part of such a thing, until months after I started modeling. As in, oh, you're one of Harriet's girls, said in a way where the capital letters are as pronounced as the words themselves. The implication varied, as it does for women who have never felt the need to shut themselves up or shrink themselves down. But whatever the impressions of Harriet, it could be counted on that we, the girls, were as quiet and as small as needed. Her voice was enough. I would walk down the halls of Harriet's office with photos of the most famous girls, the original ones watching me. And here is how foolish I was. I didn't think of them as my peers. I gave them names like I would have given dolls, Mindy, Rhiannon, Juliet. They weren't so much who I wanted to be as who I imagined watching over me. If I was coming back from a particularly good go-see, it was as if they were signaling their approval in their cocked eyebrows, saucy half-smiles. And if it had been a bad shoot, a bad meeting, their expressions would shift into something stern. Do better, Bertie. We expect more. Harriet herself would seldom be so direct. My own mother wouldn't have been able to offer an opinion that held weight with me at the time. Perhaps it sounds sad then that I leaned on photographs, not even the actual women, for some sort of instruction. Perhaps I should look back and think, of course things unfolded how they did. What other way could they have gone? But even now, years and years later, what I think is, how resourceful. My photo eventually became one line in the hallway. For a couple years, I could at least look at myself for some sort of reassurance.
That was Amy Rossi reading from The Cover Girl. One of the, there's a reference in that section to her mother, and of course, Bertie's relationship with her parents is very distant, very strained. Her parents became parents very late in life and didn't really seem to know what to do with Bertie.
Yes.
How often do you think, I mean, there's a part of us, there's a part of me that wants to think, okay, that is why she was able to be victimized, because she didn't have good parents. And as long as we have, you know, as long as my child, of course my kids are long grown, but as long as my this could never happen to my child because I wouldn't let it. But do you think that's always the case, that that there's something lacking in the family life of girls who get swept into this, or?
I don't, and I think I definitely wouldn't want to make that impression. I think for Bertie, it was a thing that let her escape her parents before the rock star even came into the picture. Her mother saw modeling as a way to kind of prove Bertie was special. And I also think, and certainly I am no expert in this, but it seems like expectations of parents have changed so much over time, and a more hands-off approach when Bertie was young wasn't necessarily, like, her mother wasn't engaged, but the more hands-off approach wouldn't have been that uncommon. But I have definitely heard stories where I think there is one girl who was part of the Sunset Strip scene as a young teenager, and her mother knew what was going on and was like, well, at least you're with these guys instead of like some rando. I guess it's okay. So I think, I mean, yeah, things can happen to anybody. And certainly being able to feel like you can confide in your parents might help, but not necessarily.
Yeah, and you're right. Parenting was more hands-off back then, for sure. Especially as you got closer, like at 18, you were kind of expected to go figure things out on your own. And now we realize in a lot of cases that that's just not possible. People, young people need more support.
Yeah, I mean, I think I am not a parent, but it seems like it is definitely about 3 full-time jobs.
Yeah. I mean, I am let's see. So Birdie was how old in
1980? She would have been 18.
She would have been 18. Okay. So she's a little bit younger than me, but not by a whole lot. And so I'm very, you know, I know what it was like growing up in that age. And things were changing so much in the world. Mm-hmm. And our parents really hadn't caught up with it.
Yeah.
I think to a large extent. So, so anyway, one of the other topics that you really bring up that you deal with in here is the AIDS crisis. And
yes.
I know that there's a personal reason for you for including that.
Yes. About 25 years ago, my dear uncle Bobby passed away from AIDS related complications. And that he was, you know, fortunate, I guess, in a way that he contracted the illness, or he started showing evidence of the illness in the 90s when there was better drugs and better treatments and greater understanding, and our family, you know, really rallied around and was able to support him. And he was just a wonderful influence on my life, and I wanted to be able to pay tribute to him in this way.
So is the character of Bobby, is that your Uncle Bobby?
That is my Uncle Bobby. I didn't even bother changing the name, and he's described the way I remember my uncle, and he is an involved uncle in the book, and that was my gift. He gave me so much in my life, and I wanted to give that back and ensure that his legacy endured. And one of the most incredible moments was telling this story at my book launch, and a friend of mine, who I hadn't seen in years and years and years, she was there, and she was like, I met your uncle, didn't I? He drove with your mom to take us to a concert. And that was just such a beautiful moment to be able to, because he's been gone for so long, to be able to talk about him with somebody who remembered him was just so wonderful.
Now, what kind of work did he do?
He worked in a food lion. He was a butcher.
Oh, wow. Okay. And mm-hmm. I can't, and in your book, does it even talk about what Bobby does?
It does not. I could imagine he might have been a butcher.
And how do he and Birdie become friends?
They become friends. So the AIDS crisis really hits the fashion industry hard. And after experiencing a personal loss and just so many other things, Birdie ends up kind of uprooting her life. And she ends up in the Boston area, and she's trying to find her place to be involved. And she attends a meeting with local organizers, and she becomes a volunteer for a local AIDS organization, and she meets Bobby as a volunteer.
Now, one of the things that you don't really talk about too much or deal with too much in the book is the money. Before she's 18, all the money she's earning is going into a trust, mm-hmm. And which she has access to later, which sort of, you know, I got the feeling that carried her through life in a sense, because but she wasn't making huge amounts of money. She wasn't getting Brooke Shields money.
No, she was not. I mean, she was supported. She worked for about 7 years without ever touching the money. So I think it was her longevity. And then, because she was completely supported by the rock star for the entire time they were together. And then, in the back of my mind, it was well invested. And then she does inherit money from her parents when they pass away.
Right, right. And then she keeps making money as a catalog model, as a bit part actress, commercials. Yes, is that actually is it possible to make a good living in and afford to live in LA doing that kind of work?
Well, she was lucky because she bought her house. I did look at her real estate prices. She bought her house a long time ago when it was a very tiny house, and I looked through the sales records. One of the interesting things I learned in my research was that catalog modeling actually pays a lot better than the more prestigious jobs, especially like a long time ago, runway modeling like didn't really become a thing until like the 60s and 70s, and it didn't really pay well. And Vogue offers so much prestige, and editorial shoots like that for other magazines offer so much prestige, but they don't actually pay that great. And so catalog modeling would probably pay enough if you were smart and invested your money wisely.
Oh, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. And is it, but it's considered sort of a step down.
Yes, it's not going to get you the prestige job. It's not going to get you a makeup contract. It's not going to put you in front of the famous photographers, but it is a paycheck.
And Birdie, in a way, didn't seem to mind that. I didn't feel like she was like, oh, I could have, you know, I was a contender and now I'm doing this thing, this stuff that's beneath me.
Yes.
I mean, her attitude was more, well, I messed up. I didn't go as far as I could, but this is worth doing too.
I think it kind of, healthy dissociation is like, seems like a weird phrase, but she kind of dissociates in a okay way as a model. And I think just feeling like she was doing something, being a body and doing what was needed was fulfilling enough for her. And then as she gets older, as long as she can, you know, make enough money to give a little bit away, that was really all she needed.
There's a phrase that you repeat often or throughout the book where she's saying, all I had to be was legs.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And her relationship to that phrase definitely changes.
Yeah. How often do you think, you know, she didn't have a lot of incidents where photographers were getting too handsy, but do you know if that's a common predicament for young models?
I don't know how often it is now that you hear. I think there's plenty of stories you hear about girls being lured to places with the promise of free photos and that kind of thing, and they're trying to break into the industry. But I think back then, especially, I mean, you hear all those old Hollywood stories too, right? I think there was definitely a line in the sand between the person who was kind of the body on set and they were expected to be a body and the person directing the film or the shoot or anything like that. And I think it was probably more common than we would want to know about.
Yeah. Yep. Now, another kind of area that you do get into in this dual timeline is the having work done. Mm-hmm. The Botox, the facelifts, et cetera. And I could see that you could have gone a very, you know, different direction with this, with Birdie doing a whole lot more than she did. Why did you choose to make her kind of hesitant to do this?
She's definitely had a lot of Botox and kind of fillers and injections. And she had been using Botox since it was an off-label use in the 90s. And she did have her nose done. That was a cocaine-related incident. And I think the pressure of plastic surgery ahead of Harriet's gala was kind of a nice metaphor. Or an embodiment of what she was experiencing, because to change her face is sort of to deny her own past, maybe, and to own her face is to own her past. And so it was kind of an externalized, it was an externalized force of what she was fighting, or an externalized way to like demonstrate what she was fighting in terms of coming to terms with what happened with the rock star.
And she's not critical of someone who does want to have more work done, surgical, facelifts and so forth. But, and I understand that, I'm at an age where it's not that uncommon. I mean, I remember my daughter 15 years ago saying, "Hey mom, have you thought about Botox?" And I'm like, "Well, I kind of like my face."
Yes.
And I still kind of like my face.
I look at the wrinkles between my eyes and I wonder sometimes, but I also have a fear of needles, but I didn't want to judge anybody, and Birdie's not judging anybody for having work done, because it's a lot of pressure, right? People are used to you looking a certain way.
And she's making her living by her looks. Mm-hmm. I don't. So it doesn't, I keep thinking, is there going to be a time when I look in the mirror and think, that's not the face I'm used to. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, thank you, Mom, I got good genes. Mm-hmm. and so not a lot of wrinkles, but it's youth. It's interesting, our society's worship of youth, and yet thinking back, life is a lot better when you're older.
Mm-hmm. There's definitely a privilege to aging, right?
Yes.
That means you're still here.
Yes, that is true. That is true. So I want to put in a little word here. You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest is Amy Rossi, author of The Cover Girl. Amy, let's talk a little bit about how you came to write this book.
Sure.
So you said you did a master's in creative writing, so I'm assuming you wanted to be a novelist.
Mm-hmm.
And was that a lifelong goal for you?
It was. It was a goal that I started writing as a kid. I would rewrite books that I had, I didn't know about fan fiction at the time, but I would finish reading a book I loved and would want the story to continue, so I would keep writing. And I wrote in high school. I tried my hand at a few manuscripts that were abandoned, and then wrote in college. And then after that, I was kind of burned out and I didn't really know what I wanted to write. And two things happened. I read a copy of Cowboys Are My Weakness by Pam Houston. I found it at the Brookline Booksmith when I was living in Boston. And that book just sort of made me think about what it was to write and all the different room there is for all kinds of voices. And it was really inspiring to me. And then I was at work and I was talking to my boss, who had also had a creative career. And I was talking about kind of my frustration with my progress in the team. And he asked me what I wanted to do. And I said, I wanted to be a writer. And he said, well, if you want to be a writer, Rossi, then write. Because I hadn't been writing, and sounds very simple, but it was the kick in the pants I needed. So I started taking it more seriously, and then ended up leaving Boston to get my MFA at LSU. And while I was a student there, while I was working on my novel, I also needed to turn in short stories for workshop. And I thought about how I'd always wanted to write about one of those girls who ended up in a relationship with a rock star, and like how that would impact the rest of her life. And so this actually started as a short story. For my MFA workshop. And one of the wonderful things I learned about writing a novel based on a short story is that you have an outline baked in. So that was very helpful, as I kind of realized the story ended up being rejected many places as I tried to publish it. And I was like, maybe it's because it's a novel. But then I had a blueprint to build from.
Oh, that is a great hint.
Well, man, could you do that again?
Yeah. So do you have some other short stories that you could convert into novels?
I wish. I am not a good short story writer is one thing I learned from my time.
Wow. Okay. So are you now writing full time, or do you have another way of paying the bills?
Yes, I do not write full time. I do write full time, but I do not write novels full time. I work in communications at a local university here in North Carolina, and I do fundraising communications.
Okay, and how does that influence, you know, so you're writing during the day, does it make it harder or easier to do the creative writing on your time off?
Sometimes harder, sometimes easier, because sometimes I feel like when I'm working on one thing, it frees up part of my brain to think about my other work, so that I do benefit from that. But sometimes it is a lot of screens all day.
Yes, yeah. So is your, what's your writing routine like for your creative writing?
I usually write at night, usually by the time everything's all settled down in the evening, probably around 8 o'clock, 8:30, I sit down with my laptop, or I do like to edit for hard copy, and I generally work from about 8 to 11, or 8:30 to 11:30, or if I'm really on a roll later than that, and then as much time as I can squeeze in on the weekends, and then if I need to take a vacation day, I do.
So you mentioned that you like to edit on hard copy, so you print out, like, do you print out what you wrote the day before and start on that?
Usually, by the time I'm doing hard copy, it's a full manuscript that I printed out.
Okay. Are you someone who does a lot of editing as you go, or are you someone who just writes very quickly?
Oh, I don't know if I'm either.
You write very slowly, but don't edit as you go.
Yes, that one. That's what my last draft was.
Okay.
The cover girl kind of came out really cleanly, and I think that was probably a little bit of editing as I went, but also having that outline to work from. So that didn't require too much editing as I went.
Now, had you written other, I mean, I'm guessing from what you said before that this is yes, but had you written other complete novels before this one?
Yes, just the master's thesis novel. And so I did query that and signed with my agent for that, but it did not end up selling.
Okay. Do you know why? Why not that one? Why this one?
Oh, I think it's just luck and timing. Mm. You know, I think that I could not even begin to approach the alchemy that is publishing, but I think I just got really lucky.
Do you think there's a chance that the other one will get, that you could rework it and that it would be publishable?
So that one was definitely more of a romp. And so I think it's harder to go from a serious novel to a romp. I am looking at taking pieces of that one and working it into the current project I'm working on.
Okay. Do you want to talk any more about your current project, or is that sort of hush hush?
I can say that it deals with a lot of the similar concepts from the cover girl, like nostalgia and what we remember and what we don't, and what it's like to be a woman in entertainment, and what it's like to be a woman on the sidelines, and the influence of pop culture on the girls we were and the women we become, men as well. But it's in a much different way.
So nostalgia, what does that really mean to you?
It's something that it's hard to put into words, to be really honest with you. But I think because I was like, for whatever reason, just like so obsessed with the 80s as a kid or as a teen. Like, you know, I was listening to like classic rock stations, listening to the Big Hair show on my local radio station on Friday nights, and watching that 70s show. And I paid to go see The Wedding Singer like an unbelievable amount of times in the theater. And as I grew older, I was just sort of like, okay, yes, you found yourself in here somewhere, and I don't really know where it was, but also, who decided what was worth carrying forward and what we should be nostalgic for. And I think because so much of my pop culture experience was tinged by nostalgia, it's just something like, I feel like it's looking back for something that never really existed and something you can never hold. And therefore, it's like kind of safe in that way because it can't disappoint you because it was never real.
You know, oh, that's a great line. It can't disappoint you because it was never real. It reminds me of Sex and the City, which I watched some when it was on to begin with, but I didn't have HBO at the time, and so I didn't really get to see it that often. And then during COVID, I watched the whole series, and I told friends that it made me feel nostalgic for a life I never lived.
Mm-hmm, exactly, yes. Yes, I think that I never hung out in my parents' basement, but I loved watching those TV shows where like teens were just like, I never had a basement. I'm nostalgic for this thing I never had.
Right, right. And I got to tell you, you know, the remake of the Sex and the City and Just Like That, which I just heard recently is being canceled, and I'm very disappointed it's being canceled. It certainly got so much flack from the press, from, you know, everybody was dumping on it, and I loved it.
My sister and I, we would watch it together. We would save up a bunch of episodes and get a nice bottle of wine, and we are definitely going to miss that time.
Yeah, I just, it's, you know, they're like, oh, this isn't realistic, but I don't think it was 60-year-old women who were saying that.
Mm-hmm.
That, it was more realistic than you realize. Yeah, no, we're not wearing the fancy clothes. And, you know, we don't have the huge closets. But it was just, again, it was escapism to some extent. Mm-hmm. But with a dose of reality in there, too. And, but the idea of being nostalgic for a time that you never lived through. What in our current pop culture, what do you see that happening now?
Oh, absolutely. I think there's, if you are, you know, routing your brain, scrolling on social media, you'll see people like really nostalgic for like the 90s, like home aesthetic. And like, you'll see a picture and I'm like, oh yeah, that is what I grew up in. Or like,
what is the 90s home aesthetic?
The certain kind of curtains and the certain kind of lighting and the pattern of the furniture and like just the way houses were designed then. I think there's just so much new construction, right? But I saw a commercial. I can't remember. I don't know if it was for like Sunny Delight. Maybe I saw a commercial the other day that was like parenting like it was 1999 and have a summer like it's 1999 and like they're out on their rollerblades and everything. And I think there is that nostalgic for a time before social media, before phones were everywhere and for all that. And you see kids like kind of looking back at like 2000s high school and was like, okay, I was there. It kind of sucked, but all right. I can see why you would be nostalgic for this time you never had.
And of course the whole trad wife thing,
mm-hmm, absolutely.
Which I find like, oh no, please, let's not do this again. But
a fellow 2025 debut has a book coming out, I think next year. It's like a horror version of it's called The Trad Wife, and it's about, by Saratoga Schaefer, and it's about, it's a horror look at that life, and I think that's going to be super interesting, and I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, for sure. So The Cover Girl is published by HarperCollins, so that's a very top-tier publisher. How did this come about for you?
I'm within Harlequin Trade Publishing, which is a division or an imprint of HarperCollins, and my agent had made contact with an editor at one of their imprints, Mira, when we were shopping my first book, and she was really looking to kind of grow her list in that kind of book club fiction space. And so when I had this next book ready, we reached out to her, and I always liken it to that scene at the end of When Harry Met Sally, when he says, you know, we got married after 3 months. And she was like, well, yeah, 12 years and 3 months. So everything happened very quickly, but it was after years and years and years of trying to get everything ready.
And what was the editing process like?
We did a round of developmental edits. I was very fortunate. I had a great amount of time to work on the developmental edits, and they were my agent and I had gone back and forth, of course, with a bunch of editing beforehand. And actually, here's a funny story. We've never discussed this, but I think one of the edits kind of suggested, like, maybe you don't need this character, Bobby. And so I ended up going back and I ended up make I just I did Bobby. I just made Bobby bigger. I doubled down, and then it worked beautifully. And so nobody had any qualms about him staying in.
Good
But
for you.
he wasn't serving the book enough. So she had a
Right.
very good point. She didn't say it outright, but I felt like that's what the edit was. And so I was
Okay,
like, well,
but the
let's double
thing
down.
is, Birdie needed some friends.
Yes, and that was something that sort of emerged organically through writing. Like, her relationship with Bernice wasn't what it was going to be, and her relationship with Bobby wasn't like as full and realized. And I really felt like those were the people she needed, and they just kind of ended up finding her in the drafting process. And I was really grateful that she had them.
Yeah, because I was feeling so sorry for Birdie in some ways, and because she was so alone and had no one that she really could talk to until Bernice, and then later Bobby, and it was a if they had not been there, I don't know if I would have liked the book.
Yes, it would have been. Wouldn't have been easy to write if it was just if there was no relief. So I definitely needed those relief points.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. There were two places in the book where I cried. You actually made me cry.
Well, I don't know if I'm sorry or if I'm grateful. Maybe both.
And of course, one was when the designer, whose name I don't remember because it's so unusual, is dying of AIDS, and the gala, the way that everyone showed up for him. Did that, were there any actual, was that patterned after any actual events?
Not that I know of. There is an episode of Designing Women where a fellow designer, interior designer, asks them to design his funeral. And I don't know if maybe that's where I started thinking about it. But that scene, I have read that scene so many times, and it makes me cry every time.
Oh. And then the other is at the end where Birdie comes to her realization. And also the resolution with Harriet. And you could have gone further with that. And I'm curious about why you decided to stop where you did.
I decided to stop where I did because it was, I think recovery is going to look really messy for her, and it's not going to be linear, and it's going to take a really long time. And I think that nod of like, okay, she's going to do it, is there. But it was about bringing her and Harriet face to face, and by being at that gala and facing Harriet, she was making the big acknowledgement that she had not made in the past however, 40
Right,
years.
right, right. So, Amy, do you have any words of wisdom, any advice for someone who wants to write a novel and get it published?
My biggest advice, I probably have a couple pieces. First, the only way out is through. You have to finish that book. You have to make a decision. It doesn't matter if you hate that decision later. The only way out is through. You got to write it. Nothing can happen until you do. And my second piece of advice is it's going to be so hard. Finding a writing community is amazing, and being plugged in with writers on social media is amazing, and you can make amazing friends. But comparing yourself to other people and their journey is going to make you miserable if you do it. So try not to do that. It's so hard. But your journey is your journey, and someone else's journey is theirs. And a bad agent, or an agent that doesn't fit your needs, is worse than not having an agent at all. And I've been so lucky with my agent, and so grateful that, you know, she's in my corner 100% and so supportive, and I can ask her anything. And I wish that for everybody. So,
well, how did you find her?
Googling. I was just like looking for agents who I was looking for younger agents or who are newer in their careers at the time, because I thought that was the easiest way to kind of break into somebody's list that's so competitive. And I was just doing a bunch of searching, and at the time she was really building her list, and so it took a couple years.
So did you like look at books that were books that you liked or that were similar in some way, and tried to find out who represented them?
I was reading the acknowledgments of every single book that I liked, and like looking at those agents and looking them up. And I think I was one of her first adult clients. So that also goes to show that you can like do all your research and do all your prep work and still end up with somebody who is the perfect fit, even if, like, I think my book was one of her first just like adult fiction books that she sold. And but she has a great track record in many genres, and I kind of like the idea of like being part of this like group of many different books.
Wow. Okay, well, I want to thank you so much for being with us today, Amy. And like I said, I loved The Cover Girl. I ended up staying up till past midnight last night finishing it. And but it was really, you had me all along the way. There wasn't any point where it's like where you lost me. So well done.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. And this has been really lovely.
And we always close with the quote. And so I decided to do a quote from Coco Chanel, which kind of talks about kind of refers to Birdie in my mind. In order to be irreplaceable, one must always be different.
I like that. Yes. Yeah.
Well, thank you, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices. Yeah.